This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, politicians, including New York's mayor, try to put the brakes on the movement against police violence and abuse. A black cop talks about racism in law enforcement, and community cop watchers in Ferguson crank up their cameras. But first, a black people's grand jury will convene in St. Louis January 3rd and 4th in response to the failure of the mostly white county grand jury to indict Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson in the killing of Michael Brown. The Black People's Grand Jury is co-sponsored by the International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement, chaired by Omali Yeshitela. He says black people cannot allow the prosecutor and his grand jury to have the last word.
No, we can't do that. There are a number of reasons for that. One, of course, is the fact that already there's so much evidence that the grand jury process was manipulated by the prosecutor McCullough in a fashion that was guaranteed to make sure that it did not indict Darren Wilson, that despite the fact that everybody knows that the grand jury is a prosecutor's tool. And that if the prosecutor wants an indictment, it'll get an indictment. But what we've learned just in terms of some of the details is that the prosecutor allowed for 2 days of testimony from at least one person that claimed to have seen Michael Brown charge the cop and seen his execution, despite the fact that the prosecutor knew that the person was lying, was not there, has a history of racist diatribe against African people, and actually raised money to defend Darren Wilson. So this is part of the information that went to a grand jury that was to make a decision on whether or not Darren Wilson had committed a crime in murdering Mike Brown. But beyond that, we understand, as many, unfortunately, of the people who are concerned about this question, black people in particular, African people who are subject to U.S. domestic colonialism, that the grand jury, like the police department, is an arm of the colonial state. There is no fundamental difference between the police department, the judges, the grand jury, the prisons, et cetera. They are part of the state. And the purpose of the state is to protect the status quo, and that is the status quo of poverty and growing immiseration by African people. So it's absolutely necessary for us to call what the grand jury did in St. Louis into question very seriously. And what we're doing is using more or less the same format that was used by the St. Louis prosecutor to examine more or less the same basic evidence that was examined by the St. Louis grand jury, and to have black people impanel as the grand jurors and see whether or not Africans would come to the same conclusions with the same evidence, more or less, that the white grand jury, I said white, but of course there were three Africans on that grand jury, but the mostly white grand jury came to in St. Louis County. We think that's really important. We think that this contributes to providing some kind of leadership to a growing mass movement that up to now has no center, has no leadership, has no ideological line, doesn't seem to be going anywhere as important as it is. And dealing with creating a black people's grand jury, we think can set a precedent, because it doesn't have to happen just in this case. We can look again at the case of Eric Garner, and it's a tool that can be used by African people in any city in this country on any occasion that we determine, and it helps to deconstruct the colonial apparatus, the colonial relationship that we have with U.S. white power.
Yes, even though that grand jury came up with a no bill, you found that the information, the testimony that came from that exercise is of some use to a properly impaneled black people's grand jury.
Yeah, and we think we can do more than that. We think that it is an inherent problem. Anytime we use a process like the grand jury, and we attempt to take an incident like what occurred with Mike Brown and Darren Wilson and to treat it as a simple incident without giving it some kind of historical context, we think that a properly impaneled grand jury that wanted to come to the best possible conclusion would have had to say something about the conditions of existence, the treatment, general treatment of black people by the police department, the police organization, and other entities of the state in Ferguson and in St. Louis County. For example, it was not Darren Wilson that made the decision to leave Mike Brown's body rotting in 100-degree-plus weather on asphalt on August 9th. Somebody else made that decision. Some other entity made that decision. It was an entire police organization that was running around wearing "I am Darren Wilson" bracelets, not Darren Wilson. And somebody gave Darren Wilson approximately $1 million as a reward for killing Mike Brown. So obviously this thing has to be placed in a greater context than what, in the best of circumstances, McCullough would have done with that grand jury that was impaneled there in St. Louis County.
At root, this impanelment of a black people's grand jury is an exercise in self-determination as it relates to a justice system that black folks could create for our own purposes.
Indeed. And what we say is that self-determination is the highest expression of democracy. What could be more democratic than to have African people examine this case? At least with African people examining this case, we have something that approximates a peer of the person who was killed. And despite the fact that, generally speaking, the U.S. government does not recognize having black people involved in examining issues concerning black people as necessarily representative of peer representation, they would have us believe that all the people in this country constitute a single body, when that is not the case at all. I mean, there were black people and white people on the slave ship coming here, but some of us were below deck and in the most oppressive kind of circumstances. The fact that white people were on the ship did not make us peers. And the fact that you can have white people and black people living in St. Louis County does not make all the people there peers. Obviously, African people in St. Louis County have a special and a particular kind of relationship to the state. And we believe that having African people who have the same aspirations, more or less the same general circumstances, the same kinds of contradictions, the same problems to solve, to have those people impaneled as a grand jury, we think speaks much more seriously to and accurately to the question of peer representation and democracy.
Now, this Black People's Grand Jury, which will convene January 3rd and January 4th, is sponsored by the International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement, your organization. But you are also interacting with lots of local folks in Ferguson and the region.
Indeed. And also, one of the biggest supporters of this is Zaki Baruti, who is of the Universal African People's Organization, who has over many years established his own reputation as a defender of the rights of black people in the St. Louis County area, and was one of the first on the scene to struggle with the people in defense of Mike Brown and his family. So Zaki Baruti, by the way, will be one of the assistant prosecutors in this issue.
In terms of this nascent movement, some people are calling it an anti-police violence movement. Others use a broader term, a racial justice movement. Well, what do you think the character of the movement is right now, and what should it be?
Well, right now it's problematic because I think it's a really powerful and profound, in many ways, social movement that has not acquired a center, has not achieved ideological or any kind of organizational clarity as such. So while it does speak specifically to the question of police violence and oppression in our communities, which is a critical question because the police functions as the first line of resistance to any challenge to the status quo, it again is open for interpretation and attempts by the enemies of the people to define what that movement is about. In fact, we are in a very serious contest at this very moment with the ruling class and its pundits and representatives such as Al Sharpton, and I just speak of him because he's one of the better known persons. We're in a real contest with them to define exactly what this movement is. And we think that we are experiencing now, in a real short period of time, a time being condensed in a fashion that after two generations of movement crush, we're seeing history move in a fashion that in a matter of 4 weeks or so, we've seen 10 years of growth in the general consciousness of the people, but it has not achieved political maturity nor clarity. And so that is why we see Obama talking about needing to have general dialogue sessions in various regions around the country, and Holder saying something similar, and Sharpton trying to make that march on Washington that occurred a week or so ago. It was an attempt to try to give a direction and definition to this powerful movement of the people, but that has not worked, and it's not working up to now. But it is incumbent upon genuine revolutionaries to intervene in the most serious way to give a direction. And I think that it has to be something that achieves the character as a struggle for self-determination. It has to move beyond trying to make white people like us, or to perfect the police organization, or to give them cameras or sensitivity training or some other simple stuff like that. The fact is that the police functions as an illegitimate entity in the African community. It is an invading force. It has no genuine business being in the African community. Anytime the police comes to our community, it comes there for the purpose of looking for trouble that it defines as crime. That's the only reason it comes. It's not like it's something that's indigenous to the community, which is why we have to say we have to have black community control of the police. So the police is not an organization that invades from the outside looking to solve what it defines as a problem. The police is an organization, an entity at the service of the people. And being at the service of the people, what that means is that it has to deal with all the problems in the community, including joblessness, homelessness, poverty, education, etc. And so it's not coming from the outside looking for problems. It is on the inside trying to solve all the contradictions of the people, which often can be seen in aggressions coming from a hostile entity like the police department that attacks us on a regular basis. So that has to be how we perceiving this and fighting this issue. Even the dress of the police has to change. They come as stormtroopers dressed in black and ski masks and things like that with special weapons. That's how they come into our communities. And even the two cops killed in Brooklyn on December 20th were engaged in some kind of anti-terrorist activity while they're in Brooklyn, in Bedford Stuy. So these entities see themselves and recognize themselves as hostile aggressors in the African community. And so we have to struggle to achieve control of all of these gun-wielding forces in the community. And that's why we say black community control of the police.
Yes, even characterizing it broadly as a racial justice movement doesn't get into whose justice? Justice as defined by whom? Justice as defined by the U.S. Justice Department?
And that's indeed, that's part of what makes it problematic. And the other thing that we see is that these are demands that virtually every liberal in the country can unite with. But we have to remember that the liberals have such sway in our communities today because of the defeat of a revolutionary movement in this country, in our community. And that the liberals are generally weak-spined forces for whom sharp and serious struggle is a problem anyway when it comes from the people. So we have to define the situation in a fashion that is not designed to cure America or to help America or to solve America's problem, but to solve the problem of the people, which is America. And liberals cannot come to that conclusion. We have to come to that conclusion, and we have to fight like hell to be involved and to intervene in this mass motion of the people, where we see from time to time, and more often than not, intervention coming from U.S. or state-sponsored groups and personalities like Sharpton, and then some of them who are actually people who are in the actual, I almost said employ, but Sharpton is in the employ as well, but actually employed and trained to do that. So we have sometimes motion that appears to be coming from the people that often comes from enemies of the people pretending to deal with this extraordinarily important question that's impacting in our community.
Who do you anticipate will be testifying before the black people's grand jury in St. Louis?
Well, we're struggling like hell to get Doran Johnson, the brother who was with Mike Brown when he was killed. And we're looking at pathologists. There are even some former black policemen from that county who want to testify, and some ordinary people who can testify how in St. Louis County, black people riding three deep in a car will always be stopped. We have people who can testify about how the 60% or more of the income for Ferguson, for municipal income, comes through stopping and charging black people, et cetera. Part of what this does, of course, is to show that we're looking at more than Mike Brown. And then we have forensic pathologists who we have their testimony, and hopefully we'll have an actual testimony from someone who we're trying to be in touch with right now, who has a completely different take on why Michael Brown would have been shot twice in the top of his head by Darren Wilson, that challenges this whole notion that he was shot in the top of his head because he had head down charging this man who had already shot him several times.
You also have the testimony by Darren Wilson himself that rather than making a snap decision in fear for his life to use this deadly force, he actually contemplated the legal ramifications of what he was about to do.
And not only that, but he's someone who's able to say in retrospect that he has no regrets at all. He would have done it the same way. He is someone who testified that he had been hit two or three times and was a fear of loss of consciousness or even death, yet was able to hop out of the car, unstrap himself, and then shoot Mike Brown pretty accurately and kill him. He was able to testify with a lie, and we've seen this as an interesting contradiction because the prosecutor worked very seriously to get Darren Wilson's supervisor to say that Darren Wilson told him, the supervisor, that he was aware that some cigars had been stolen when he stopped Mike Brown. The supervisor, of course, said that Darren Wilson told him the opposite, that he was not aware of it on the one hand, yet Darren Wilson's testimony states that when he saw the guy wearing certain colored clothing, he recognized that it was the same clothing that was worn by the person who stole the cigars, and that Mike Brown, in beating him, was switching the cigars from one hand to the other as he used different hands to punch him with, which was just absolutely absurd, and nobody rationally would have accepted that except white people's jury in the employ of St. Louis County.
Omali Yeshitela of the International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement. Yeshitela is also chairman of the Black is Back Coalition. An estimated 25,000 police officers from New York City and around the country gathered for the funeral of Rafael Ramos, one of two cops shot to death the previous week by a lone black gunman. In the wake of the killings, Mayor Bill de Blasio and some black and Latino politicians have called on movement activists to tamp down on what they call anti-police rhetoric. We spoke to Dr. Johanna Fernandez, a professor of history and African American studies at Baruch College in New York and an activist in the movement against police abuse.
Part of what we see happening is that people of color, including our president, are quick to side with and defend and mourn and denounce the shooting deaths of police officers, but they are not willing to come out with the same ferocity to condemn the shooting deaths of ordinary people and black young men in particular, which essentially is proving to the world, but also to the people who built this movement, that in fact, black lives do not matter. So the response of politicians to the police killings and the fact that they seem to be more concerned with the lives of police officers than they are with the lives of young black people, I think is going to create a greater crisis of legitimacy, not just for the police, but for the American government and its local representatives in New York, in St. Louis, in Detroit, and around the country.
Yes, this urging to tamp down the demonstrations has not had that effect on the demonstrators. The protests continue.
Absolutely. I think that the fact that over 1,000 people protested on Fifth Avenue on the same day that Mayor de Blasio asked demonstrators to suspend protests is a sign that the movement is not going to easily disappear into the night. Part of what we know is that police violence is a systemic issue in the United States, and demonstrators are coming to these protests with a deep sense of the systemic problem of police violence in our society. And we've seen the videos, not just of Eric Garner, but of countless hundreds, thousands of men and women who've either been abused or killed by the police. And I think it's important to remember, and I think communities of color understand this because they live it every day, that behind every police killing, you have thousands of moments and experiences of police violence in local neighborhoods that does not lead to a death. So this is a problem that we've only begun to explore, that American society has only begun to scratch the surface of, but the communities of color right here in New York have been living with for decades.
You wrote in your recent article that when police officers and politicians begin using scare tactics to disarm the militancy of the growing movement, we have to remember that that's a tactic that they've rehearsed throughout U.S. history. You are a professor of African American studies. It appears that you're saying that this police aggressiveness in the wake of the two killings is par for the course and should be expected.
Well, part of what we saw happening in the late 1960s was a deployment of law and order politics to criminalize the growing militancy of the Black Power movement during that period. And in many ways, the law and order politics that have given the police so much power over the last 40, 50 years was part of a reaction, a backlash, and a punishment on Black people for daring to fight against racial oppression and against the power of the police. So yes, part of what we see happening, part of the campaign that has brought together the head of the Police Benevolent Association, the mayor, and local council people to convince protesters to go home, that's a tactic that's been long rehearsed by people in authority to undermine movements. Another important issue here is that we are told by the police department in New York that we absolutely positively need police, that demonstrators would not know what to do if the police were to remove themselves from urban communities. And, you know, I think part of what we have to say to the police is that the issue of crime is one that has been blown out of proportion by politicians and by the police, and that the level of armament that the police has today, its militarization and their large numbers, are disproportionate to the existence of crime in our communities. As I mentioned in the article, crime has gone down in many communities systematically, but police aggression has climbed exponentially, and the number of police and their militarization has increased. And at some point, we have to begin to explore alternatives to this warlike mentality that the police carry with them into our communities. I was just out in my neighborhood about 45 minutes ago, and I witnessed a young man being apprehended by the police. The young man was running away. By the way, the young man was white, which is interesting because Washington Heights is a predominantly Dominican and African American community. The police ran after this young man. They apprehended him. They did not beat him up. Had he been Hispanic or African American, he would definitely have been beaten up. But within seconds, I counted over 20 police officers gathered to apprehend a lanky young white man who seemed to have a mental illness. Before the people who gathered could blink, there were at least three undercover cops there for this one single person who essentially, as soon as he was apprehended, gave himself in. The amount of resources that New York City is spending for one man to be apprehended by at least 20 police officers is beyond anything that anyone in any normal society can imagine. Meanwhile, our schools are falling apart, our hospitals are falling apart, there are no jobs, and our communities have fallen into disrepair. So what this conversation around police violence and the power of the police is raising in American society is a deeper question about our nation's priorities and how we handle and address social problems.
And as you mentioned in your piece, killings of police officers is at an historical low. And also, we saw decades during which crime rates were actually going down, but incarceration rates continued to climb.
Absolutely. So part of what we must conclude is that the growing militarization of the police and the growing deployment of violent power on the part of the state and the police is an attempt to contain a bigger problem, which is the problem of class stratification. You probably heard the statistics, and that is that over the last 30 years, the United States has witnessed the largest transfer of wealth that has ever happened in history. And that transfer of wealth happened from the bottom of society to the top, eviscerating poor people, working class people, but also the middle class. And part of what a Harvard economist says about this transfer is that when this massive transfer of wealth from the bottom of society to the top has happened in the past, it's happened as a result of a revolution or a military coup. But in the United States, it happened without a peak. How has this society been able to contain the normal social upheaval and eruption that comes when the ruling class eviscerates the people at the bottom of society? It's been able to maintain control through the militarization of the police, but also through the mass incarceration of people that it's decided are no longer useful to society. And so that's what I think this movement needs to begin to address, because our prisons are larger than ever. We know the statistics that the United States incarcerates 25% of the world's population, but we only represent 5% of the world's population. The first line of defense in that project of mass incarceration is the apprehension of people in the streets by the police. In order for the system of mass incarceration to have grown the way it has, the police needed to have been given an enormous amount of power to systematically violate the rights of people in urban communities day in and day out through constant harassment. So yes, we are becoming a police state, in fact, because we need a police state to control a society that has grown so unequal.
So how deeply has this conversation about the deeper contradictions in U.S. society penetrated the movement that we see growing in the streets?
It's unclear to what extent the movement has, in fact, absorbed this analysis, but I think it is the job of alternative media. It is the job of leading activists on the ground to incorporate this analysis. I mean, this is why leadership is so critical, and that really is the next step in this movement. We need a massive education campaign that will explore the systemic character of police racism and police violence, that explores the history of the police, which, as you know, emerges in the United States as a force to apprehend escaped slaves and return slaves to their masters, but also to police growing black urban communities in the early 1800s, like Five Points, which, contrary to popular belief, was not a neighborhood of poor Irish people, but it was at its inception a poor, free black neighborhood in New York. So the police have not always existed in history. As a modern force, it has its origins in the early 1800s. In this nation, it's connected to the institution of slavery, and it is critical to policing crowds and emerging urban communities. Another issue that is critical that we have to educate the public about is the issue of crime. Not until the late 1960s did crime become a central issue in public policy discussions. And in fact, it was an issue that was manufactured. There wasn't a growing problem of crime. For the better part of human history, crime rates have remained the same. But the issue of crime was manufactured by politicians to criminalize the Black Power and Civil Rights Movement, and to delegitimize the concerns and the leadership of organizations like the Black Panther Party. So it's really up to the people in demonstrations, the leadership, the Black Lives Matter, to begin this conversation that will assess the problem more systematically, because when we assess the problem systematically, we'll come up with solutions that will be more transformative and will produce greater change. But again, none of this is automatic. It has to be fought for on the ground. But we see this happening already, because we haven't had a conversation around police violence as large as the one that we're having in all of American history.
And yet it is conversations like this that politicians might characterize as hateful and divisive rhetoric.
Absolutely. And this is really a moment for the movement to raise the issue of freedom of speech and freedom of association as part of the demands of the movement, because politicians will try every trick in the book to silence a growing critique of the police. And the reason why the police are as scared as they are, and the reason why the state is as scared as it is because when you have a movement organized around the police and its authoritarian power, that opens broader questions about society. Right? Its organization and its priorities. In many ways, it has the capacity, this movement around the police, to open up a revolutionary conversation in American society. And that's precisely why they're going to throw the book at the movement. I've heard that they have already begun to knock at the doors of people who've articulated controversial words about the police on Facebook. I've heard from a number of folks, and this is going around on Facebook, that the police are closely monitoring the media. So again, this is where we need to get organizations like the ACLU involved in the conversation and in fact sue the mayor, right? I think the mayor needs to be sued for using his authority to undermine the Constitution of the United States and First Amendment rights. This needs to become a conversation, a part of public discourse in American society.
Dr. Johanna Fernandez is coordinator of the campaign to bring Mumia Abu-Jamal home. Abu-Jamal has been keeping track of the growing movement against police violence from his cell at Frackville State Prison in Pennsylvania. He says politicians talk constantly about respecting the police, but where is their respect for black life?
Throughout much of modern American history, The season of mass demonstrations has been spring and summer. Look at old black and white photos of the anti-war, civil rights, and black power demonstrations of the 1960s and 70s, and you'll see people in t-shirts or simply dressed in shirts and jeans. The dress reflected the ease of the weather. Like in old military theory, the ground or terrain is important when planning battles. Now look at today, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people amass in biting cold, in wind, rain, and even snow. This is thus something new in social movements, perhaps enhanced by social media, but strengthened too by a deep sense that change must come to an intolerable situation, police violence against unarmed black men and boys. For at the heart of every meaningful movement of the 20th century has been the beating hearts of black people. And let's face it, black people aren't really fond of the cold. This should give us some sense of how deeply these issues resonate in black minds. Now, after the shootings of two cops in New York, come calls from politicians to suspend demos out of respect. The question arises, who respects whom? When cops killed Mike Brown, Eric Garner, and Tamir Rice, who showed respect for them? Brown was literally demonized by his killer. Garner, we were told, was too fat to survive his choking and should have just meekly submitted to the attack on him. Tamir, a child, was big for his age and scared cops, they said. Amazing. According to police bargaining unit head Patrick Lynch, Garner's killer was a model officer, an Eagle Scout, and just doing his job. Yeah, choking a man to death for suspicion of selling a cigarette. Real respectful, huh? Oh, by the way, the verb lynch comes from, we are informed by anti-lynching activist Ida B. Wells, Pittsylvania County, Virginia, around 1780, when a Colonel William Lynch instituted hangings for horse thieves. A crusading journalist, Ida B. Wells, would be amazed at how easily blacks could be killed in the 21st century by police without due process. Her keen eye would survey New York, Cleveland, Ferguson, and beyond, and perhaps she would recognize modern-day lynch law.
That was Mumia Abu-Jamal reporting for Prison Radio. Matthew Fogg is a career law enforcement officer, a former deputy U.S. Marshal, and whistleblower who's also active in Washington, D.C.'s Hands Up Coalition. Fogg has been outspoken against racism among police. We asked Fogg if many cops view themselves as a law unto themselves.
As law enforcement, we're trained and we're taught that when you're on that street, you have to protect yourself and you're out there to enforce the law. Now, of course, once they started this whole thing called the so-called war on drugs, that sort of changed the sort of paradigm considerably because there's so much discretion that you could get away with when you're going after somebody with drugs. First thing you say, well, if they're selling drugs, most likely they're going to have a weapon or they're going to try to protect those drugs and they're going to have their own sort of law enforcement system themselves. So you're going into a war-like scenario. That's the way it became. So it was like, do whatever necessary to effect an arrest. Our training says whatever level of force it takes to effect an arrest, you have that discretionary to do that. So officers started, you got that, I call that discretionary window, that whether or not you can use force that would be considered excessive to others, you've got that window open to you. And then when you look at even the prosecution, like we hear all the time, the prosecutor works with us, the law enforcement people, because they're not investigators. So we're the ones who got to go out there and get them all of the information, evidence they need, so they have a great rapport with us. And therefore, if we go awry, most likely those prosecutors are going to cover us because they know they got to depend on us.
You're also a member of the Hands Up Coalition, D.C. How does it feel for you, a lifelong cop, being part of a movement that is largely an anti-police movement?
Well, I've always believed that police need to be accountable. not just a hands-up coalition. I started my own organization called Congress Against Racism and Corruption in Law Enforcement. I'm a whistleblower in law enforcement. New York Post did a front page story on me in 1997 called it Bigots with Badges. I'm now hoping that's going to be my book. I'm working on it to get it out. So I've always been one that believes that you have to have a standard of accountability for police, because power begets power, and before you know it, it's very easy for cops, if they become corrupt, to destroy a whole system of cops. And that's often what I hear people say, well, you know, all cops are being thrown under the bus. That. No. No, we get paid to be policemen. We get paid to do our job. But if you do get a policeman that goes awry and becomes bad cop, he can have a devastating effect on a large number of people, including the community and other cops. I always say a rogue cop is the same as a terrorist. He has the training, the skills, and the means to hurt people and to kill folks. You've got all of that. So you're a rogue cop.
Well, is that the problem? Is it rogue cops, or is it a problem of an imbalance in power and a very wrong relationship between police and the black community?
Well, it's both. You've got rogue cops, and then you do have a culture of indifference in the sense that you have a racial imbalance in law enforcement. And that's what I did see. And certainly, oftentimes, you'll have people that will be, for example, if somebody's a racist and that person is in a command and control in a management position, practically everybody who wants to be promoted or wants to grow in their career, wants to do a good job in their career, they're going to follow along with him, even though they may not necessarily agree with him. Then that's how you become a culture of indifference. And when we see the various things that have happened in law enforcement, like the one that I always like to bring up is the Abner Louima situation in New York, where the police officers felt so comfortable, they brought the guy inside the police station to commit these heinous crimes, knowing other cops would come in the bathroom and see him. So that said, there was a culture there in place. So to answer the question, yes, once you get this sort of paradigm that is doing things a certain way that might have a disparate impact on a particular race of people, the paradigm continues. Everybody just does what they want to, unless somebody brings some accountability to it, say, wait a minute, this is wrong. We're doing this the wrong way. We need to correct it. And if you happen to be one of those people like myself that blows the whistle on it, then your life becomes in danger. You become in peril. I was left on a stakeout to be cured. My black partner up in New York, somehow he wound up dead. The white partner that blew the whistle on what they were doing to the black folks, they ran him off the job, fired him. So there's all of these sort of repercussions that occur if you speak out against that so-called blue wall of silence that might be doing it the wrong way.
In your years in law enforcement, have you ever witnessed, experienced an effective program of community control of police? And what would such a program look like?
I believe there should be civilian review boards, where the community does have input in what the police do and decisions the police make and can govern the police from that perspective. And so I clearly believe that there should be independent of the prosecutor's office, independent of the police department, separate review board. And the same thing with the prosecutor, taking away that sort of symbiotic or that sort of close sort of marriage between the prosecutor and the grand jury. Change that. I used to work on the grand jury in Washington, D.C. I was assigned to the grand jury section, and I saw the close relationship that the prosecutors had with the grand jury when they would take a stack of indictments in and give them to the grand jury. And just like, you know, most people have heard now that through the Eric Garner case and the Michael Brown case, that prosecutors have a very close relationship with these grand jurors to the point that where the grand jurors in that room, and they feel like, if the prosecutor says he wants you indicted, they feel like they got to do that. They feel like that's their civic duty to do what the prosecutor is telling them to do. They lose autonomy that they don't have to operate in that way. But they lose it in that close relationship. And that's why they say now you can indict a ham sandwich. Because it's like saying once the prosecutor, that's what he wants to get done.
Well, you've talked about rogue cops and some rogue departments. But I hear that you have some choice words
about a rogue agency with a global reach, the CIA.
Yes, indeed. Having been on the board of directors for Amnesty International and understanding human rights violations, and also having worked at the Foreign Fugitive Desk for the U.S. Marshals, which means I had to work with over 140-something countries around the world, tracking fugitives from all over the world, and I had to be on the phone with the law enforcement officials in other countries through our network called Interpol, International Police Organization. Oftentimes, when our fugitives, or when we send a communication overseas to Spain, to Russia, places where there's a fugitive, we want to have that fugitive extradited back to the United States, I would always say to the people that I was communicating with, look, don't beat these people, don't harm them, don't torture them, don't do anything that would lead it to believe that that's what we wanted you to do to them before we got them back here. I would always say that. And so now here we're finding out that we got a government that the same blue wall of silence that we say operates within law enforcement, where officers don't come forward or keep things from their superiors or hide the information, okay? We're finding our whole nation operates. The CIA is doing. Now we're finding out from these reports, they did the same thing. They kept certain things. They operated in a rogue way that was in total violation of the Geneva Convention and against everything that we understand as human rights officials. They operated totally contrary to it. That whole blue wall of silence popping up again. And it seems to be a culture within America that, you know, America is this sort of blue wall of silence that keeps everything hidden until years later. Then we come out and find out how roguish we really were.
Former Deputy U.S. Marshal Matthew Fogg in Washington. President Obama claims he wants to put cameras on the nation's cops. But in Ferguson, Missouri, community activists are putting cameras in the hands of the people to keep the cops in check. David Witt is an organizer of the Canfield Watchmen, named after the apartment complex near the street where Michael Brown was killed back in August.
The Canfield Watchmen is a group of residents here in Canfield Green that after the murder of Mike Brown, what happened was that night that the police had finally left, people came out in the Canfield and they began putting candles in the middle of the street. For some reason, the trash can in our neighborhood was set on fire. Who had done it, we don't know. But what happened was the police came down there in the neighborhood and we had an officer. They actually tried to run over the memorial in the middle of the street because it was just candles there. A brother got on top of the car, told him to back the car up, you know, and then we had all of these cops like lying down the street, at least 30 police, okay? That night, under one voice, okay, this whole complex, along with, you know, other people that came down to Canfield, when the police told us to disperse and leave, we all said, no, I am Mike Brown. And we just kept chanting that, you know, like, we kept chanting that until they actually got in their cars. Well, they never got out of their cars, but they told the one head guy that was out there, was like, look, just tell the people to get out of the way. We're going to get ready to leave, okay? So they left. What happened after that, we recognized, I myself know, because I was born and raised D.C., so I've seen this stuff before. This is the middle of America. It hasn't hit like it has already hit in all of the major cities. Okay, so I knew they was coming back, because every time a memorial is erected, okay, after the death of a person that's been killed by police, the police come down and they shut those memorials down. So the Canfield's Watchman's primary goal was to ensure that the memorial was going to be here and that the people that came down here to Canfield to visit and view, they wouldn't have to worry about nobody trying to attack them or anything like that. So we actually did a real good job. It's because of the residents in Canfield that this memorial is still standing today. Okay. Now, what we did after that, because, you know, this is, like I said, this again is about, you know, watching the police. We had a guy by the name of Jacob Crawford, right? He was in California. And when the news at first broke about all the stuff that was going on out here in Ferguson, he got on a plane and he came out here. And in his job, he just came out here to go and videotape police activity, doing protests and stuff like that. But I ran into him. He came down to Canfield, and we had a nice long conversation. He even interviewed me that day, and I left my number with him. And I said, hey, you know, if you guys are still in town, come down here, you know, and just hang out with us for a bit because we're going to be out here, you know. So he's like, cool. 2 days later, he gave me a call because they was gassing the people up on West Florissant so bad. Like, it was a cloud of smoke from West Florissant all the way into our neighborhood. My wife could smell the stuff, and her eyes was burning in the house, and I stay all the way in the back of Canfield. But anyway, that guy called me and was like, hey, man, you know, we need to get off of the streets. Is it cool if we come down there? And I said, yeah, you guys come stay at my house, okay? So they came down here. I let them stay at my house, and that night we sat and we talked about what was happening outside. And so he explained to me more about what Cop Watch is about and how they, you know, implement Cop Watch out in California. And I was like, man, I said, I've been watching cops my whole life. I just ain't have no camera. Immediately after that, he said, you know what? We're going to get some cameras out here. He said, I'm going to go online and I'm going to start a GoFundMe so we can get cameras in Canfield. By the next morning, we had $1,000, okay, that we had raised overnight because of what Jacob did, okay? After that morning, we went out and we bought 4 cameras, okay, so we can be able to watch the police in our neighborhood. But that night, we posted on Facebook that we got these cameras also to show the people that had donated money that we have already put this money to use, and we showed the cameras that we're going to be out here tonight, okay? That night, okay, we raised out another $500. So we went out and got a laptop and hard drive so we can actually start building something, okay? A week later, we had raised over $5,000, okay, on a GoFundMe. By the end of it all, we had raised over $8,000 off the GoFundMe for the camera initiative. So first week that we had the GoFundMe going, we realized we had to make a responsible choice and a decision on what to do with this money, okay? Because in the thing, it basically states that, you know, we're getting some cameras for the residents. So we said, okay, we're going to still give the cameras out to the residents. We're going to get some body cameras so we can be able to give more people cameras and not just a select number of people. We said we're going to give everybody that goes to this 1 hour Know Your Rights class, we're going to give them a body camera as almost like a consolation prize after they finish the class. This is what we did. We wind up giving out 210 body cameras to date, okay? And all those people that have those body cameras went through at least a 1 hour class of Know Your Rights. So, yeah, so the Canfield Watchmen, basically, we just used the Cop Watch to continue our movement. But in addition to that, we have one of our Canfield Watchmen members that is the president of the Center of Hope and Peace that's right on West Florissant. And what that's going to be is going to be the community center for not just North County, but the entire St. Louis area, because we're going to have shop classes up in there. We're going to have a studio. We got the blueprint written out. We are right now are trying to drum up some financial support. We have taken on other jobs in addition to watching the police or protecting our neighborhood.
David Witt of the Canfield Watchmen in Ferguson, Missouri. Blacks in Milwaukee, Wisconsin continue to seek justice for Dontre Hamilton, who was shot 14 times by a white cop who claimed that Hamilton tried to hit him with his own police baton. Hamilton's brother, Nate, and others journeyed to Chicago for a rally at the Rainbow Push Coalition this past weekend.
On April 30th, they took a 31-year-old's life. He massacred my brother. He stood there and looked at him. He sized him up, and he killed him with hate. He killed him with intent. And now he has the mental problem. He been had the mental problem. The whole system has a mental problem. And no longer will we have a mental problem of depression. We won't sit here and have anger. We will turn that into positive energy. will release that upon this beast.
Yes, sir.
This is a beast.
That's right.
And only the people can take down the beast.
Right.
So on today, we activating the power of the people.
Yes,
all people, far and wide, come out. Let's stand together. Let's unite. We don't have to be that voice of reason. My family doesn't have to be that voice of reason to come out and say no violence. We don't. You know who has to be that voice of reason? The mayor has to be that voice of reason. The police chief has to be that voice of reason. The district attorney has to be the voice of reason. Not my family. Not any family that has to go through an injustice. Do we have to tell the people to calm? The people has been calm.
Right.
The people has not stood up.
Come on, Nate.
So when will we stand up?
Right.
We have to stand up.
Yeah.
Activate the power of the people.
That's right.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.